This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Talks are underway in Nigeria to avert a nationwide strike. Two of the country's top labor federations say they'll strike Wednesday if the government does not reverse its decision to raise the price of fuel. The federal government has filed a suit against the unions, and a court ruled Tuesday that if the strike goes ahead as planned, the unions will be found in contempt.
That's Chiman Nwankwo reporting from Abuja. Details coming up.
Also, a new report says as many as 800,000 migrants and refugees in Libya want to come to Europe. The UN is expressing concern about increased violence and detentions in Burundi, and an international conference in Denmark aims to help the world's girls and women thrive.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, new reports from security agencies indicate the migrant and refugee crisis will not end soon. In a joint report, Europol and Interpol estimate there are about 800,000 migrants and refugees in Libya alone waiting to travel to Europe. Most of those making the dangerous Mediterranean journey to Europe leave from Libya by hiring people smugglers. Many use flimsy rubber dinghies because European naval patrols have been destroying wooden vessels used by smugglers. The report warns migrants may be coerced into criminal activities and unaccompanied minors could be sexually exploited. Migrants and refugees reportedly paid between $3,200 and $6,500 apiece to traffickers. The report also estimates that human trafficking to Europe in 2015 was a nearly $6 billion business.
Talks are underway in Nigeria to try to avert a nationwide strike. Two of the country's top labor federations say they will strike tomorrow if the government does not reverse its decision to raise the price of fuel. Chiman Nwankwo reports from Abuja.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity.
Workers chanted outside the office in Abuja, where union leaders and the government met for a second day Tuesday. Last week, the government raised the price of fuel by 67%. The country's largest labor federation, the Nigeria Labor Congress, NLC, says it should have been consulted and will not accept the government's decree. Government negotiator Adams Oshomole says subsidizing fuel is bad policy.
Even at the population growth rate of 3% per annum, that our consumption has expanded so much that according to official figures, by 2015-2014, Nigeria spent about 1.2 trillion. And then you have a subsidy regime that takes about half of your earning.
1.2 trillion naira is equal to just over $6 billion. Nigeria is even more cash-strapped now than it was in 2012 when the previous administration tried to remove the fuel subsidy. A nationwide strike and days of street protests forced the government to reconsider. This time, the government appears to be pursuing a strategy of divide and conquer. The NLC includes some of the country's largest and most powerful unions. An official said Tuesday, at least four of those unions are no longer endorsing the strike. But Joe Ajero of the National Union of Electricity Workers told VOA that is not exactly true.
There are issues we gave them, and they gave us one document, you know, to a police study, so that by tomorrow we'll convene. Yes, sorry, today, by 5, we'll convene. So no one can say we have disassociated or whatever.
The drop in global oil prices since last year has plunged Nigeria into a financial crisis. An acute fuel shortage is further hurting the economy. Chima Nwankwo for VOA News, Abuja.
The UN is expressing concern about increased violence and the rising number of detentions in Burundi. Spokesman Farron Hawk says UN officials are monitoring the situation. More than 500 people have been killed in the past year and close to 300,000 displaced in neighboring countries. Violence started in April of last year when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term, something opponents called unconstitutional and a violation of the Arusha Peace Accords that ended Burundi's civil war.
In other news on Burundi, the European Union suspended direct aid to the administration of President Nkurunziza earlier this year. However, last week, the EU's Commission for International Cooperation and Development announced $62 million in aid for the people of Burundi. Spokesman Alessane Polak says the funds for health care, rural development and nutrition will bypass the government. Instead, they will be funneled through local and international NGOs. Polak talked to VOA's David Arnold about the needs of the Burundian people after more than a year of street violence, an alleged coup attempt and large-scale civilian flight.
What they will do is really to provide direct support to the population of Burundi in two sectors, one being health, the second one being food security and nutrition. What we really want to do is to continue to support directly the population of Burundi because we're not in a capacity to channel any financial support to the Burundian nation anymore following a decision that has been taken by the European Union Council. But the Burundian population is the one paying the highest price to the crisis in Burundi. So that's why we want to continue to be active on this front, supporting directly the population.
How do you get around the government?
Yeah, but if you look at what we do concretely, we are able, through organizations such as the Red Cross, for instance, you know, to assist directly rural population. If you take about health, we are able as well to work with local NGO or international NGO to directly support local or district health structures. So it's about supporting directly the communities at the local level. It's not the ideal situation. Rarely use as European Union this, what we call this Article 96 of stopping directly support to the government. That's really our last resort measure usually. But of course, our objective is one day we can again continue to support through the schools or the health system, but we're not there yet. So we have to adapt to the situation and find ways to continue support the population.
Are you concerned that the government of Burundi might actually obstruct your efforts?
Our position is clear. We continue our dialogue, including with the government of Burundi, because there is no solution if there is no dialogue. And that's why we continue to support in Burundi the dialogue, regionally as well, internationally. We think that everyone in Burundi will think that helping directly the population is a good thing.
Give us a European view of what the problems are for the people of Burundi right now.
There is a clear problem of access to basic health, particularly to women and children under five. The information we have from the ground is like the government of Burundi is really squeezing social expenditure more and more. So what we want to do is directly to support health structure, clinics, hospitals. The second sector, I mean, it's about food, rural development and nutrition. Here again, we really see and all the studies show that nutrition rates that are getting really worse and really a lack of access to food in rural Burundi or other part of the country. It's focusing a lot on children, which are the most affected by nutrition. And that's why we really hope to reach again directly through some Burundian NGOs as well or international NGOs.
What are some of the specific strategies that you hope will be implemented for children and for nutrition?
What we're trying to do is to work on the diversification of production, because the real problem when there is food shortages is the children don't have access to the food they need. So first having the three meals a day and then support directly the agriculture by giving seed, by helping with fertilizer, by helping directly the cooperatives of the agricultural organization so that there is not a dramatic drop of the production and so that communities and families continue to have access to the basic nutrition additives they need. Because if a child doesn't get access to the basic nutritious food in the first year of its life, it will impact him throughout his life. No one is going to build tomorrow's Burundi if the children of Burundi today are not directly supported.
Thousands of Burundians have left the country, but this food aid would only be available domestically. Is that correct?
That's why we've got in parallel already humanitarian assistance that is targeting the Burundian population in the neighboring countries. So we're supporting the refugees, and then we'll have to support their integration. What is new is we had announced already humanitarian assistance for Burundians that had fled the country, but so far we were a bit blocked by the stalemate and the political situation. We had to find, you know, innovative ways and new partners on the ground to continue to help the population.
That was Alessandro Polak, spokesman for the European Union from Brussels. He spoke to VOA's David Arnold.
Fifteen minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown says more than 30 million children uprooted from their homes by conflict and violence will have a chance to resume their education. Brown is UN Special Envoy for Global Education. He briefed the United Nations yesterday about the project.
Amidst the carnage of war and the destruction of life, and the abandonment of hope for so many people, I can report that there is a breakthrough today for young children who are in desperate need of education in conflict zones and who have been on the streets, subject to exploitation by child labor, child marriage, and child trafficking, but who may have hope that they could be in school in the next few years. And what I'm able to announce today is that for this lost generation, we are creating the first humanitarian fund for education in emergencies. It will be launched next week at the World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul. It is the result of 3 years' work by UNICEF, UNESCO, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, UNDP, the World Bank, the Global Partnership for Education, and the major donor countries in the world.
Brown says the education fund will be unique in several ways.
It will be a partnership between the public and private sectors, and there will be a window for business, for philanthropists, and for humanitarian foundations. We will seek to involve not just existing donors, but new donor governments and international agencies. We will have a special window for IT companies because of the importance of online education for children who are uprooted from their homes and may have as an only chance of getting education the use of mobile phones and the use of iPads. We will be the first to bridge the gap between humanitarian aid and development aid. At present, education falls through the net. Most humanitarian aid goes, as you would expect, to food and shelter, and development aid is long-term and not geared to an emergency.
That's former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who's now the UN Special Envoy for Global Education. He says the projected budget for the Humanitarian Education Fund is expected to be announced in September.
Advocates, policymakers, grassroots activists, world leaders, and youth from over 160 countries are meeting in Copenhagen, Denmark this week. They are attending the Woman Deliver Conference. One of those attending the Woman Deliver Conference is economist Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, who served two terms as Nigeria's finance minister. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips about why economics plays a vital role in the mission of the conference.
There's been a lot of work now done and evidenced by the World Bank in the World Development Report a couple of years ago, as well as recent work done by McKinsey on gender parity that shows that including women in the workplace and giving them the same chances and opportunities as men really contributes to increasing global income and global well-being. And it starts from the way that women interact in the household. Women who are economically empowered make sure their children go to school, that the health care of their children is much better, that their household is well taken care of in terms of nutrition. The entire well-being of their families and their communities is better. And also then you can take that up to the level of the country and the globe. You know, if you give women farmers the same amount of inputs as you give to the men, they have been shown to have even higher yields. If women could have the same opportunities at work as men, you would raise global income by about $12 trillion. Imagine that. Those are very, very, very big numbers. And women have enormous purchasing power. A study a few years ago, I think by Ernst & Young, showed that women make an $18 trillion market globally. Their purchasing power is that big. So you can just see from all angles, women have the power to do this when they are given the chance.
Tell me a little bit about the Women Deliver Conference. What do you really want people to get at this conference from your own experience?
The first is my experience as Minister of Finance in Nigeria from August 2011 to May 2015, where we had an experiment in which we tried to use the budget. This issue of gender mainstreaming, we've talked about it for so long, and I felt we were not making progress much as I would like. And when I talked to the president, he was very supportive of the idea of trying to use the budget as an instrument to further empower women, saying to ministers, if you can achieve concrete results for girls and women over and above what you would have done in your program, you will get additional budget as an incentive for this. And we had wonderful results from the Ministry of Agriculture. Dr. Adesina, who is now president of the African Development Bank, developed an electronic wallet system to allow women and men farmers to get inputs directly for their farming instead of through the middleman. And he was able to put another 2.5 million women to get these electronic wallets, and he got additional disbursements of money for that. We had the Ministry of Water Resources, where the minister had a program with women trying to manage water and sanitation facilities in village communities and did it so well. We had the Ministry of Works, where women were being trained to be subcontractors in public works. And this is amazing, you know, because you know in the area of public works and construction, women are very scarce, but we were able to get additional numbers of women and girls trained. So that's a very specific example of empowering more women. Another one is with the information technology minister. We said if you could reach girls and women and train them in information technology, in coding, in repairing machines, in various aspects of both hardware and software management, you'd get additional resources. And she established a program in the secondary schools precisely to train young girls in these things, and that was a success. And that was empowering them with skills which they would not otherwise have had and which would enable them to be employable. This is important news to share with women at this conference.
It must be very gratifying, I imagine, to see this kind of success for women in Africa.
Absolutely. Women are the bedrock of development in Africa. You know, if you look in agriculture, you see that in most African countries, 50 to 70% of the workforce in agriculture is women. You see that women make up almost half of those who have small and medium enterprises. So I think trying to spur the economy on the continent without looking at how you can directly work to improve productivity of women, I think we'll be missing a very significant input.
That was economist Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, former finance minister of Nigeria and the current board chairman of the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
An Ethiopian scientist and former state minister of agriculture, Professor Tekalin Mamo, has won the 2016 IFA Norman Borlaug Award. It was given in recognition of his outstanding contribution to improving soil health and natural resources in Ethiopia. Each year, the award is granted by the International Fertilizer Industry Association, IFA, to a person who has made significant advances in crop nutrition. Tekalin's work has benefited over 11 million smallholder farmers in Ethiopia and helped rehabilitate more than 15 million hectares of degraded land over the past 10 years. The prize winner spoke with me about his approach to the various problems regarding soil health and how his work is helping to alleviate poverty and hunger in Ethiopia.
So we decided that, one, we should have a common approach. Second, our approach should be bottom-up, in which we engage the farming community and we first make awareness creation so that the farming community own the problem, prioritize the problem of land degradation, and we developed a community-based watershed development strategy that focuses on community sensitization, community ownership.
So what does this mean for people
regarding having enough food to put on the table now?
We have like large areas of cultivated land, but the major problem has been the productivity has been too low. As you said, soils have been degraded, nutrients have been depleted, input use has been very low because farmers do not immediately get the benefits, and so on. So the government, specifically the Ministry of Agriculture, strategized during the past decade and a half how to increase production productivity by strengthening the extension system, by also scaling up best practices. For example, about 10 years ago, we also launched acid soil rehabilitation program. In Ethiopia, we have vast areas of acid soils that are unproductive. So using agricultural land, we could rehabilitate vast areas. On these vertisols or black cotton clay soils, there is waterlogging. And we also developed a technology that helps to drain excess moisture from such fields where farmers can plant early, harvest early, and even plant for a second time and increase their production productivity. We also made sure that the fertilizer should be custom-made. What do the soils need? The specific soils, the specific environments. What do the crops need? So we launched 4 years ago a cutting-edge digital soil fertility mapping program, and that is almost now finished. By coming December, we'll finish the whole initiative in the country, customize the fertilizers, produce some of the blended fertilizers locally, and so on.
Looking at the effects of El Nino and how it induced or helped to induce a drought in Ethiopia, how have farmers been able to cope with that El Nino effect?
This El Nino has been the worst incident in Ethiopia's history, like in the past 50 years or so. Everybody would have expected that the effect would have been worse. But what did help the farmers is already they have regreened their ecosystems. They have conserved and rehabilitated about 20 million hectares of land. So all that helped them to counter the impacts of El Nino. Otherwise, if we didn't do this, it would have been like twice or three times the number of people that require now food assistance.
Looking ahead at the effects of climate change on land degradation, what challenges do you see and how are you going to tackle these challenges?
I think from the climate change perspective, we have to adopt both mitigation and adaptation mechanisms, as it has been reflected in Ethiopia's climate-resilient grain economy. And we have to keep on rehabilitating all the lands, keep them green, so in case of any climate change or climate shocks, their resistance and tolerance will increase from time to time. I think one important challenge we may have, and that may be common in many developing countries, is forecasting capacity for such events. It should be there. Once we know that, then the necessary preparedness and measures can also be effected and implemented.
That was Professor Tekeline Mamo, Ethiopia's former State Minister of Agriculture and recipient of the 2016 Norman Borlaug Award.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss whether there's a need for a fundamental change in U.S.-Africa relations. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss U.S.-Africa relations next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.